The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Hi, this is Kevin McCullough. Thanks for listening to the Christian Outlook podcast, where we cover today's issues from a perspective that honors your Christian faith. Our podcast is brought to you through a partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Here's another piece I trust you'll enjoy.
Joining me, Dr. Stephen Meyer. He's a philosopher of science. He received his PhD in the philosophy of science from the University of Cambridge. He's the author of several books. We're going to be talking about his book, Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe. I've had the privilege of having him on for his work, Signature in the Cell, Darwin's Doubt. Dr. Stephen Meyer, thanks so much for being my guest.
Gino, thank you for having me back. I appreciate it.
Well, it's great having you back. And I remember long ago, you know, when we were talking about your first book, Signature in the Cell, and then Darwin's Doubt, this book seems to be a kind of, dare I use the euphemism, coming out of the closet. You're not coming out of the closet for just any good reason. The return of the God hypothesis, you're making a case that there's a greater likelihood that there is a God than that there is not a God. That when we ask and we answer the question, not just simply why is there something rather than nothing, you're making the suggestion that there is a God who seems to bear a great resemblance to the Judeo-Christian God of the Bible. Now, I know you don't argue for the Judeo-Christian God of the Bible, but when you say return to the God hypothesis, have you come to some resolution of what kind of a God is that God is?
Well, I'm a believing Christian and have been since my early 20s, maybe before. I had a long, tortuous conversion
journey
that probably involved way too much overthinking of things. So, so I believe in the God of the Bible, of the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament, the God of Judeo-Christian scripture. The book shows that there is evidence for not just a designing intelligence of some kind, which is what I argued for in
right.
the first two books that I wrote, The Signature in the Cell and Darwin's Doubt, which you kindly mentioned, but also that there is evidence for that the designing intelligence responsible for life has additional attributes besides intelligence, one of which is transcendence, the type of intelligent designer necessary to explain not just the evidence we have from biology, but also from physics and mm-hmm. cosmology and astrophysics, suggests a designing agent who is capable of structuring and creating the whole of the universe and therefore must transcend the universe, must be both active in it, but also in some ways separate from it in order to act as its ultimate cause. Now, that's completely consistent with the Judeo-Christian conception of God, and that of perhaps other the conception of God held by other classical theists.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a deistic conception of God, where God only acts at the beginning, because we have evidence of intelligent design arising within our Earth's biosphere long after the beginning. Nor is it a conception of God that's consistent only with the idea of an immanent intelligence acting within the creation, because we have evidence of design from the very beginning that affects the whole of the universe. So what I did in the book was weigh these competing worldview hypotheses and evaluate them against the evidence we have about biological, physical, and cosmological origins. And I argue that theism, with the concept of a transcendent, personal, powerful, and intelligent creator, best fits the bill.
My guest is Stephen Meyer. We're talking about his book, Return of the God Hypothesis. You really need to get this book. Now, again, in Return of the God Hypothesis, Stephen, you begin the book by revisiting really the history of the pre-scientific era, the scientific era, the post-scientific era. You're talking about the reality. You, along with many people who have written about the philosophy of science, argue that science, as we understand it, wouldn't exist unless there was this Judeo-Christian worldview that was brought to bear to even make science possible.
Now, right, that's the story arc of the book.
Right.
In addition to making an argument, presenting evidence and making an argument, the book tells a story. And the story is a rise-fall-rise plot structure, if you will. Modern science began in a Judeo-Christian context in Western Europe during a very particular period of time. Historians of science who study this period, known as the Scientific Revolution, tell us that the Judeo-Christian worldview was not an incidental attribute of the scientists who were studying nature, but it was for biblical and theistic reasons that these scientists began to study nature in the very systematic way in which they did. For example, the scientists during this period of time believed that nature was intelligible. This is a key word. They believed that nature could be understood, that it had secrets that could be understood because it had been made by a rational creator, namely the Judeo-Christian God of the Bible, and that same God had made us in his image, and therefore we had a kind of rationality that would enable us to understand the rationality, the order, and the design that God had built into nature. So Johannes Kepler, the great German astronomer, said that natural philosophers, which is what they called scientists at the time, have the high calling of thinking God's thoughts after him. Nature has an intelligible order that we can understand because we've been made in the image of that same rational creator, and he has imparted his reason within us so that we can understand the reason of the world around us. So that's just one element of the Judeo-Christian worldview that contributed to the rise of modern science. Mm-hmm. Another is that these early scientists believed that they were studying nature in order to help reveal the glory of God, the design and the purpose and the rationality that had been imbued into nature. And they also believed that they were studying a creation that could have been otherwise. It depended solely on the will of God. Yes, there was an order built into nature, but he could have structured nature in many orderly ways. And it was therefore up to us to go and look and to see how he did it. Robert Boyle, a famous chemist, said that it is not up to us to ask what God must have done, but rather to go and see what he did do. And this was in striking contrast to the great Greek thinkers and their more philosophical approach. The Greeks did study nature, but they believed that nature was subject to an intrinsic logic that they could perceive without observation, that whatever seemed most logical to us, most orderly to us, was the way that God must have things, or the way nature must be ordered. So they thought that the most perfect motion was a circular motion and assumed that the planets were, or rather, they thought it the other way around, that the sun was moving around the earth in a perfectly circular orbit. Later, Kepler discovered, of course, that the orbits of the planets were in ellipses, and that was something you could only determine by observation. So understanding the creation, something that was conditioned on the will of God, made all the difference. It inspired an empirical observation science.
Before we continue our conversation, Stephen, tell people where they can get a copy of Return of the God Hypothesis. And by the way, congratulations. So many people are buying the book and reading the book.
Well, thank you. Thanks for asking. The book is available at all the online sellers,
right.
Barnes & Noble, Indie Books, Books A Million, Amazon. And I have a website for the book with the title in the website address, returnofthegodhypothesis.com.
So returnofthegodhypothesis.com. And just quickly, what other resources will people find at that website?
Well, you can navigate from that website to my author page and to the other to the websites for the other two books that I've written, as well as a YouTube channel that has videos of debates and that I've done with our worthy opponents on the other side of this argument. Presentations I've made with people like Eric Metaxas, who interviewed me about the book a while back, one of his Socrates in the City events, and animations that take you inside the cell to help visualize all the intricate nanotechnology and digital information technology that's at work inside cells. So lots of cool stuff. If you're into this subject, it's a great place to start. And I thank all your listeners for their interest.
Well, and it really is a great place to start. The book is Return of the God Hypothesis. And just very briefly, in the three scientific discoveries that reveal the mind behind the universe, you talk about the beginning. You talk about fine-tuning. But you also talk about, dare I use the term, this Cambrian explosion, the fact that there seems to be good evidence that we've acquired information that makes both the presence of life and the proliferation of life on the planet almost inexplicable unless there's some sort of mind directing this process.
Right, right. Just to put my answer in context, too, and to segue a bit from the last segment, you have this tremendous the influence of Judeo-Christian ideas on the rise of modern science. By the end of the 19th century, there's a big shift, and with Darwin, Marx, later with Freud, and other thinkers, and you get a much more materialistic worldview as the basis of science. And it's out of that background that we have so many claims today still that science and Christianity are at war. But in the book, I tell the story of three big discoveries that have occurred over the last century and right up into the present time that challenge that warfare narrative and, in fact, point in exactly the opposite direction, showing that science properly understood supports theistic belief, especially when we drill down on these big questions of origins about the origin of the universe, the origin of its finely tuned structure that makes it capable of hosting life, and the origin of, as you just mentioned, the amazing informational properties that we find inside cells. We all know about the Watson and Crick discovery in 1953. They discovered the structure of the double helix, the DNA molecule with its shape. But 5 years later, in 1957, 58, Francis Crick proposes what I think is one of the most extraordinary hypotheses in the history of science. He recognizes intuitively that the DNA is storing information in some way. And he proposes that the four chemical letters or subunits, chemical subunits called the bases or nucleotide bases, are functioning like letters in an alphabetic, alphabetic letters in a section of meaningful English text. Mm-hmm. Or they may be functioning like the zeros and ones in a section of software. That is to say, it's not their physical properties that give DNA its function, but rather their arrangement, their specific arrangement in accord with a code. And that hypothesis later confirmed, and that is sort of the crowning achievement of what's known as the molecular biological revolution. But that created a huge impasse eventually for people trying to explain the origin of life, because to explain the origin of the first cell, you now have to explain the origin of an information-rich code at the foundation of every living cell, even the simplest cells. And since then, we've also discovered that DNA is only part of a much larger information storage, transmission, and processing system that rivals anything that we've developed in high-tech digital computing. So it's just an extraordinary discovery. And yet what we know from our experience is that information, whenever we find it, and especially if we find it in an alphabetic or digital form, always arises from an intelligent source, whether we're talking about computer code or a hieroglyphic inscription or a paragraph in a book, or even the information we're transmitting back and forth over a radio signal now. Information always comes from an intelligent source. And so the discovery of information at the foundation of life is a powerful indicator of a designing intelligence. And that's one of the huge, one of the big three discoveries that's pointing in a theistic direction.
You know, one of the things that you do masterfully obviously, we understand the skepticism of the late 18th, the early 19th century. But at the beginning of the book, that skepticism sort of manifests itself in a kind of cynicism. To me, skepticism is different from cynicism. Skepticism says, I don't believe, but I'm willing to be persuaded by the facts. Cynicism says, not only do I not believe, but I'm not even prepared to deal with the facts. And you've been so gracious and kind to your opponents. Do you think that humility is going to win the day? Because you talk about the fact that the philosophical materialist still doesn't have an adequate explanation of why there's something rather than nothing, how life literally came from inorganic material to organic material. Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry to interrupt. Yeah, I think it's very important always to represent the argument of any interlocutor in the way that your intellectual opponent would himself or herself represent it. Otherwise, you're guilty of critiquing a straw man, a position that the opposite party doesn't hold. And so my training in philosophy is, I think, coming to bear there. I've always got a voice in the back of my head making sure that I don't misrepresent the position and represent it fairly. Mm-hmm. As for the cosmological evidence, this is such an exciting story, and I tell it in the book. Beginning in the 1920s, the observational astronomers detect that the light coming from distant galaxies, first they determine that there are other galaxies, and once they have established that, they determine that the light coming from these distant galaxies is being stretched out. Its wavelengths are longer than it should otherwise be if the objects in the night sky are a constant distance from us. And the term of art in astronomy is redshift, because redder light has longer wavelengths than other light in the visible spectrum. In any case, the astronomers discern that the galaxies are moving away, and therefore the universe is expanding. But if you wind the clock backwards in the reverse direction of time, then the galactic material would be getting closer and closer and closer and would be bunching up the further you go back. And eventually it would converge on a point marking the beginning of the expansion of the universe and arguably the beginning of the universe. And over the next century, there have been a series of observations in the field of astronomy, as well as developments in theoretical physics that have added weight to that conclusion of a beginning. And one of the most important ones came in theoretical physics as a result of Einstein's new theory of general relativity, new in 1915, not anymore. And the key idea there was that matter is actually curving, that massive bodies curve space.
Right.
And if matter was bunching up as you go in the reverse direction, this would have been getting more and more tightly curved until finally it reached a limit of infinite curvature corresponding to zero spatial volume, marking the beginning of space and time and the universe itself. Now, at that point, you can no longer posit a materialistic cause for the origin of the universe, because before that time, there is no time and no matter, no space, no energy, no matter to do the causing. And therefore, you must look for a causal explanation that transcends those domains. And as you look at the competing worldview hypotheses, theism and deism both posit a God who fits that bill, an agent who fits that bill, who exists independently of the universe, who could bring it into existence. Materialism does not.
And think of our conversation, ladies and gentlemen, as a tiny taste of what to expect from Stephen Meyer's new book, Return of the God Hypothesis. Go to the website, Return of the God Hypothesis. It'll take you also to stephenmeyer.org. Thanks so much for being my guest.
Thanks for listening to Christian Outlook. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. If you enjoy our podcast, take a moment and tell a friend to subscribe today.